Thank you for listening to Rearview Mirror Chronicles. If you'd like to contact me, you can send an email to rearviewmirrorchronicles@gmail.com. Hello, and welcome to Rearview Mirror Chronicles. My name is Keith Hockton. I'm a public historian, author, and broadcaster. A couple of years ago, as COVID-19 was reaching its peak, its zenith, and the global shutdowns were reoccurring, I thought a lot about pandemics of the past. I thought about the 19th century Asiatic dysenteries like cholera. I thought about the Black Death. I thought about the Justinian Plague in the 6th century, which proved pretty devastating across the Persian and Roman empires in the Mediterranean and the Near East. And then, of course, I thought about the great influenza of 1918-19 and previous waves of influenza. And then I thought of Boris Johnson, who was in intensive care at one stage, fighting for his life due to COVID-19. And of course, that made me then think about David Lloyd George, who was completely debilitated by influenza in 1918. And in fact, I think also Lord Salisbury as well, in a previous wave of influenza. So British prime ministers and leaders had a tough time of it in these pandemics. And of course, they're on the front line. So on this podcast, I'm linking them all up. I'm learning what we can learn from history of pandemics. I had a really interesting conversation about this topic just the other week with an American here by the name of Tash, who is well-versed on all things political. In fact, I have to say it was the best political discussion that I've heard in years. That discussion and that subject really had me thinking in very different ways about pandemics and politics for weeks afterwards. And that led me to doing more research. So thank you, Tash, if you were listening in. An American writer and thinker, Brian Michael Jenkins, has also written a book about how societies respond to pandemics. He's gone back through history and he's seeing if you can tease out the lessons to help us get a bit of a perspective on what we went through. And with my history hat on, my history background, I put two and two together and came up with an idea, a few pointers, if you like, about how things are likely to progress if we encounter another pandemic in the future, and I'm pretty sure we will. If history has shown us anything, is that history repeats itself. I've also spent a lot of time thinking about how terrorism is changing and morphing to pose a threat as well, not just in the US, but further afield. And I want to talk more about that too, because I think there's a correlation between pandemics of the past and what we're now seeing, and I think we can actually learn from them. So this is actually applied history. I mean, I can't remember at what stage during the pandemic it was when I started to think, you know, we need to look back at examples from the past and try and harvest useful lessons and perspectives from history. To be honest with you, it could have been when my father died. He died of associated complications that involved COVID. And it was during those dark days when I started this research to try and make sense of it all. You know, during the pandemic, with people protesting around the world at masks, at shutdowns, you know, when people were losing their businesses, I actually wondered how COVID-19 might affect the future of violence. You know, would it continue to radicalize? And the answer I came to was yes. Would it encourage terrorists to employ biological weapons? Not necessarily. Would it start wars? I don't know. So I looked at the past for clues and I became increasingly fascinated with the subject of plagues. There was the Plague of Athens, there was the Justinian Plague, the Black Death, and the reoccurring waves of the Black Death that literally lasted 400 years. There were the cholera epidemics of the 19th century, the 1918 flu, and so on. And they really provided clues to the effects of pandemics on the economy, on society, on psychology, on people's moods, and of course, political consequences. I kept reading and taking notes, lots of notes, and this podcast is a factor of not just these notes, but also that one conversation that kind of galvanized me a few weeks ago. So what are some of the top findings, if you like? I mean, presumably mortality, the effect of sudden spikes of mortality upon societies. Is that something that's very striking? It is, although there's a sharp difference. I mean, as a comparison on the toll, the human toll of COVID-19 with the mortality of past pandemics, it really suggests that we are not seeing that level of mortality simply because of improvements in science, improvements in medical treatments, and of course, on the development of vaccines. I mean, in the 14th century, the Black Death killed half the population of Europe, and the 1918 flu killed between 50 and 100 million people. That was about 3% of the world's population at the time, which was then about 1.8 billion souls. Today, close to 600 million people worldwide have been infected with COVID, and of those, about 6.5 million have died. That's about 1.1% of total cases. So we're not talking about depopulation here. We're not talking about a massive loss of life. You know, we're not seeing bodies piled high and mass graves. So that leads to an issue that people can look at those numbers and they can look at the personal risk involved and reach quite different conclusions. If you're wondering if that's one of the lessons that we've been able to learn from history compared to the present, yeah, there's a mortality effect, there's a demographic effect, but there's also this political and ideological effect of the hardening, if you like, of the partisanship around things like mask wearing, around the measures that we had to take across the world. Pandemics can give a knock to the actual size of the population for sure, but they also give a shape to the foundation of political certainties. I then ask myself if they can be transformative politically as well. And the answer is yes, absolutely. One of the fascinating findings during this research was the fact that I suppose historians looking at past pandemics would find relatively few surprises if they looked at COVID-19. I mean, sudden outbreaks of disease require prompt and aggressive government intervention to protect people. It goes without saying. And whether it's in the form of quarantines of the current age or the lazarettos, you know, the pest houses to which people were consigned in the Middle Ages, or whether it's the shutdowns and the social distancing that we saw during COVID-19, they provoke responses. They provoke resistance. You know, pandemics all the way through history carved deep scars into the economies. And that's a reoccurring theme. They completely overturn economies. Pandemics affect societies unequally. Of that, I have no doubt. And they not only affect countries unequally. I mean, in the COVID-19 case, the developing world economies were mightily affected, and it's going to take them far longer to recover than it will first world economies. Tens of millions of people worldwide, hundreds of millions of people, according to some estimates, are being pushed back into absolute poverty. And by that, I mean not having enough income to provide basic food and shelter. They also provoked resistance. They provoked social disorders. There's a great deal of scapegoating that takes place, you know, people blaming others for it. We saw this take place. And that often then leads to a lack of trust in each other, in your next door neighbor. And I think what's really fascinating about that is that there is some research that indicates that lack of trust is inherited by the following generations. In other words, two generations beyond, even three generations beyond the 1918 flu pandemic, we are still seeing higher levels of distrust among the descendants of those pandemics to those people who were most exposed in that pandemic. Those are sort of constant features of how the landscape is, in a sense, trashed by the dragon's tail, if you will. Look, I've listed a bunch of fascinating aspects of kind of post-pandemic life, but let's talk about the first one. You know, I mentioned state intervention. Historians of the 18th century, people I admire, actually talk about the development of physical military states. So war forges these states that turns them into bodies that are actually capable of efficiently raising money and spending money on weapons and on the battlefield. And the states that fail that test have practically disappeared off the map. And it makes me wonder whether actually there's something else going on here. Should we be talking about some of the physical health states as well? Because a lot of these advances in some state power, you know, state intervention in the rest of the economy, in this society, they've come as a response to these gigantic challenges posed by these pandemics. So the question then is, do they leave a lasting legacy? And I would argue that they do. They must. I mean, they have to. And indeed, as part of that process of centralization of states and the expansion of state power, you know, the military were used not only to fight wars with other nations, but they were also used as sort of a general purpose instrument to control the populations. So the military forces were actually called out to quell rebellions, to put down strikes, to enforce quarantines. We saw that happen. They were then used to close borders during pandemics, to seal off nations. So the military had and has a much broader role in society. And that role expands significantly during the time of pandemics, because what the rulers were doing, even in the past, what they were doing even before the modern states, is essentially trying to isolate their own state, their own kingdom, their own principality from the dangers of these diseases. And the way that they did that was basically to close the gates of the castle, to, you know, pull up the drawbridge and to suspend trade and to prevent people from traveling. That had a direct impact on people's lives and livelihoods. History repeats itself. And of course, that provoked resistance. So the imposition of state control and the resistance of that is a continuing feature of pandemics throughout recorded history. On that note, let's take a brief break and hear a message from our sponsor. Ultidomus is your one-stop shop for your Malaysia My Second Home visa. But they are much more than that. When you sign up with Ultidomus, you become part of a larger community, a community that cares about you in Malaysia. And that's important when you move to a new home. So for more information, call Ultidomus or WhatsApp them on +60 12 493 7270 or visit their website www.penangmyhome.com. And we are back. Another thing I found was the depopulation or the upheavals. They can accelerate change that maybe was already obvious, but it got accelerated by the pandemic. So for example, the move to working from home in the more recent one, or in Britain, because, you know, my mum still lives there, a sort of messing about with, you know, video calls for family doctor appointments. And they've been doing this for over a decade, but suddenly overnight, they made that happen. The governments made that happen. You know, the giant immovable bureaucracy suddenly just shifted because they had to. The question that I then had was, is this something that happened in previous pandemics? Can it accelerate what was already manifest? So maybe a declining empire under Justinian, for example, was dealt a significant body blow by that plague. And the conclusion is that certainly there have been. I suppose one of the most striking examples would be during the successive outbreaks of the Black Death in England in the 14th century. And of course, you know, the first wave of the Black Death was in 1348, but there were subsequent waves. It happened again in 1360. It happened again in 1369 and in 1375. And that actually set off a chain of events and probably in the long term benefited the peasants, those at the bottom of the economic period. But it also started the Peasants' Revolt and the Great Uprising of 1381, which was really England's first major social revolution. History has cause and effect, and it worked in an odd way. Depopulation benefited the peasants. It created a labor shortage that accelerated the breakdown of the manorial system. You know, that system where the peasants owned the owner of the land, the barons, if you like, goods or money or services, in return for the use of land to grow crops for themselves and for their landowner. You know, as labor became more scarce, The lords, the barons, had to compete for fewer workers who gained greater mobility. And what this did was simply accelerated the process of putting them in a better bargaining position. Of course, the barons didn't like that, and under pressure from them, the crown then tried to enforce new labor laws, new price controls, even sumptuary laws prohibiting these uppity peasants from, dressing, as simple as that, as dressing, as if they were, in a sense, above their station in life. At the same time, the king needed a great deal of money for the continuing war with France, so he then imposed new taxes that really fell hardest on the poorest. And the poll tax of 1380 led to a massive revolt. What that led to was the peasants marching on London. They took control of the city, and the new king, King Richard II, met with them. He promised them reforms, the mobs dispersed, but of course, then he used that disbursement to crush the entire movement, and then he took back all of his promises. It was all a lie, a delaying tactic. And what do you learn from this? That governments have been lying to the people for a very long time, and they continue to get away with it. But nonetheless, that rebellion signified the new power of the peasants. And over the long run, it actually transformed the relationships, the basic relationships in the United Kingdom with the powers that be. I then looked at what was going on around us in the world today that feels familiar to what I had seen in the societies of the past, how they rebuild after the pandemics. Rulers, whether kings of yore or modern presidents and prime ministers, don't like pandemics. They are not good news for someone with political aspirations or political agendas and political ambitions. They're just not. They're difficult to deal with. Control measures can probably slow the spread of the disease, of course, and they can reduce the number of deaths. But the fact is that the deaths continue to accumulate. And it's really extremely difficult to control any of those measures. So in some cases, what we see in the early stages of these pandemics throughout history is an effort to deny that they're even taking place. Does this sound familiar? Even to the point of the beginning to manipulate the numbers, the reports, when we begin to have modern reports. So again, nothing new, because we saw governments do exactly the same thing during COVID. And of course, people accused governments of not taking it seriously enough, that they were not reporting the deaths accurately enough, and that they weren't doing enough. But if you go back to the cholera epidemic of the 19th century, we can actually find numerous examples in which governments did exactly that. And in some cases, even cooking the numbers, that is, fiddling with the reports to try and pretend that there was not a great pandemic going on. And of course, we saw this in the early days of the COVID pandemic. But of course, that then fuels another aspect, which is the reoccurring aspect. And that is something that fuels not only suspicion, but it also fuels all sorts of conspiracy theories. And we saw these popping up again and again, and they continue to pop up again and again. I mean, it's actually useful to get this history to kind of illuminate things that are going on at the moment. But the past tells me we can't or we shouldn't try to make predictions about moving forward. Not just in this particular set of circumstances, not just because I'm talking about this. I've been a researcher for many, many years, and it imposes humility, if anything, in a sense, about one's ability to predict even the smallest move in the future. Look, we didn't know how or when the COVID-19 pandemic would end. No one could predict that. And to be honest, I'm not even sure that it has ended. But what I'm positive of, because I've seen it, I am seeing it, is that the post-pandemic landscape is really one of complete uncertainty. And that's maybe its principal feature. What we do know is that the normalcy that we knew before the pandemic will never return, and that a post-pandemic society is completely different from the way things were to the pandemic. Going back to what I said at the beginning of this podcast, when I was talking about conflict and terrorism, don't you find it interesting that the Russian invasion of Ukraine came after the peak of COVID-19? Don't you find it interesting that China has ramped up its aggression against Taiwan? I then asked myself if these are coincidental or are they related? And it's a hard question to answer because the relationship between war and pandemics is difficult to disentangle. I mean, war and pandemics circle about each other like, you know, binary stars, you know, throughout history. And one of the analytical challenges is that wars are such a constant feature of our history and pandemics are such reoccurring events in our history that it is actually difficult to find a pandemic that is not, in a sense, in close proximity to an ongoing war. You know, of course, the Black Death took place during the Hundred Years' War between, you know, England and France. And if we go back through the history of, let's say, modern Europe from the Middle Ages on, it's actually difficult to find a long period of peace anywhere. And so if you were to just randomly distribute pandemics throughout that history, as I say, one would fall on top of a war in close proximity to a war almost all the time. Of course, now in some cases, pandemics create such disruptions that actually lead to war. You know, in some cases, we see pandemics that create social stress. In other words, they actually destroy economies. You know, they create desperate people. And these people can coalesce into rebellions. You know, the desperate poor can go on the move and become migrants into other societies. And I suspect one thing that we will certainly see as a consequence of COVID-19 and as a consequence of its economic effects in the developing world, we're definitely going to see increased migration pressures coming from some of these countries that have not only already been impoverished, but further impoverished by the pandemic. And desperate people are going to start trying to get to places like Europe or other places like the United States in growing numbers, simply reflecting their circumstances and what has happened over the ensuing years. And there are already high tensions in these countries about the presence of immigrants in these societies. And those tensions are going to definitely drive those with white supremacist populations and those with nativist ideologies. So it's not the pandemics directly that lead to wars, but they create conditions, the disturbances, the pressures that in turn can manifest themselves into disorders, rebellions, and warfare. Food for thought, folks. Food for thought. Thank you for listening. Bye for now.